Founded in 1879, the Austro-Hungarian Evidence Bureau was the first permanent military intelligence service in the world. In 1901, Colonel Alfred Redl was appointed head of counter-espionage. Redl's reign saw a burst of innovation, helping propel Austro-Hungary to the forefront of the espionage world. What nobody knew was that Redl was a double agent, also working as a spy for the Russian Empire. His exposure in the run-up to the First World War created a huge intelligence and political scandal in Austro-Hungary and led to Redl's suicide. Hello, my name is Gareth Edwards and welcome to the Untitled History Podcast. Join me each week alongside world-leading experts as we take a deep dive into your favorite topics from throughout history. From the ancient world to the modern, and with plenty of historical rabbit holes in between, we'll cover famous and not so famous moments in history from all across the globe. In this episode, we're going to discuss this often forgotten spy scandal and why it deserves to be better remembered today. I am, of course, your host, Gareth Edwards, aka John Bull. And with me today, I am delighted to say that I've got Jesse Alexander. Say hello, Jesse.
Hello, thanks for having me.
It's great having you on. For those unfamiliar, Jesse has a master's in history from the University of Vienna. And he's also the co-host of our sister podcast on World War II, Both Sides of the Wire. He's also a man who has introduced me to many great Austrian bars, particularly Vienna bars. So there was only one person I wanted to have on when we were talking about Redl. It just seemed entirely appropriate.
Makes sense. You can't be in Vienna and not try to enjoy the quality of life here.
And I think that there's an element of setting the tone really for this episode, I think, in that, because that is exactly what's going to come up as part of this. So maybe actually for those who are unfamiliar, I'm just going to set the scene a bit here, which is, it's entirely possible these days, now that we are more than 100 years on from this, that some listeners might not even realize that Austria, as it was part of Austro-Hungary then, it was an empire. It was an enormous and important world power at this time that we're talking about, this turn of the 20th century, wasn't it?
Yes, we tend to forget, I think, a little bit. We focus on today's maps, today's countries all the time when we're thinking about the past. Austria-Hungary was one of the major great powers. It's got a population of something like 50 million, which at the time, for example, is larger than France or Britain. It controls much of Central and Southeastern Europe. So today's countries like Hungary or Southern Poland or Western Ukraine or chunks of today's Serbia, Croatia, all of that under the control of this big empire, under the Habsburg dynasty. And they're involved in all the great power shenanigans and competition that we know. Vienna is quite important. If memory serves, it's the fourth largest city in the world at this time.
And I think people really need to grasp the scale of this. They need to think of what we're talking about when we're talking. Austro-Hungary is, as you say, it's a world power. It's equivalent to France. It's equivalent to Britain. It's equivalent to Russia. It's arguably bigger than the Ottomans, who are already starting to decline at this point. It is a world player. And I want people, as they're listening, if they're not familiar with this era, to just bear that in mind. As Jesse says, don't take the modern map version. Think of this as, this is a country operating on a global scale, in the same scale now that we talk about China and America and Russia as superpowers. Austro-Hungary was a superpower at the time. And that really sets the scene, doesn't it, for where we're going. I mean, Jesse, maybe we'll talk a bit more about general sort of intelligence position in a bit, but why is intelligence so critical to Austro-Hungary at this time?
Well, of course, it's critical for all of these powers, but Austria-Hungary finds itself in, let's say, maybe a bit of a particular bind. Geography is not that kind, and neither are politics to Austria-Hungary in the second part of the 19th century. So what you have is, in the second half of the 19th century, second half of the 1800s, right, you have these great powers and they're competing with each other. And there are a couple of wars in the 1860s that don't go Austria-Hungary's way. They lose a couple of provinces and they're perceived as vulnerable, and they perceive themselves as being vulnerable. They are a great power, but they are significantly weaker than their main potential enemy, that is the Russian Empire. So if you're in that kind of situation, and they have a potential enemy on their other side as well, in Italy, new country in quotation marks, right? So the modern kingdom of Italy comes about in the 1860s. And so they have claims on some Austro-Hungarian territory. So if you're in this situation where you have this competition, you have potential enemies, and you've just had the Industrial Revolution, which means that the way wars potentially could break out has now changed. The timetable has accelerated because you're not going to have armies marching to the frontier all the way from the interior, taking weeks. Then you're going to have time for your scouts to come back and tell you and organize your armies. You need intelligence much faster when they're going to be moving by rail within a few days, for example. So the technological development and the political developments mean that Austria-Hungary is in a bit of a pressure cooker and mean that intelligence is going to be critical if they're going to hope to survive in the case of another great power war.
It really is worth emphasizing that. Mobilization is a huge thing in this period. And a bit later from when we're talking about when we hit World War I, it's going to be critical. The speed with which you as a country can mobilize and understanding how quickly other countries can mobilize their armies is a key intelligence goal throughout this period, because it can inform where you send your first soldiers to. This will come through in World War I. You know, where do you send which front when you're someone like Austria, who has multiple fronts? Which front do you need to get troops to quickest to make sure they can defend that front or advance on that front? So I think that's critical and really something that does get overlooked a bit when you kind of think about these periods.
Yeah, and this is all linked into planning, of course, because if a war is going to break out, yes, you can react, but you need fairly detailed plans which reflect your intentions. And you know your enemy's going to be doing the same thing. You want to get your hands on those plans. You want to get insight into those intentions of a potential enemy. And that's really kind of the bread and butter of what are you trying to do? What kind of intelligence would you be trying to collect on a potential enemy? In the case of the Austro-Hungarians, it's the Italians and the Russians, but especially the Russians. You want to know what are their intentions going to be, and also what are their capabilities going to be? How many men are they going to have in this area? How many trains? What's the capacity of the railway? What are their mobilization plans? What are their concentration plans? How are their fortifications set up? All those kinds of things.
And as you mentioned earlier already, two critical wars for people to think of in this area are the Austro-Sardinian War and the Austro-Prussian War. And I think that those are the things that really trigger Austria-Hungary into really accelerating its intelligence program. But again, just on what you were saying there, they showed the scale of what Austria-Hungary is having to deal with. You know, it's Italy, it's Germany, it's France, it's Russia, it's everyone. They are stuck in the middle of everything. So let's talk a bit about the Evidence Bureau and its foundation. So it's an imperial institution. And again, in Austria-Hungary terms, something to remember is, as Jesse hinted as always, Hungary and Austria are, in theory, relatively equal partners in this enterprise. I mean, it's theory, isn't it? But it's a complex relationship.
It is, because of these wars in the 1860s, the nature of the Austrian Empire politically kind of changes. And it becomes Austria-Hungary in 1867. There's what's called the Great Compromise, where they essentially kind of split the state partly in two, and they keep some common areas, and they divide most domestic areas of administration. So they have defense, foreign affairs, and finance is common to both Austria and the Kingdom of Hungary. And intelligence and the Evidence Bureau, they fall into this common area. So the Evidence Bureau goes through different phases in its history. You're not going to, you know, you're not going to be facing the exact same level of threats over the decades. So things go kind of up and down. But in the period where Radl becomes significant, so the first 10 years of the 20th century, let's say, they're in a phase, they're in between two phases, or they overlap two phases, let's say. So the very start of the 20th century, things are not going terribly badly for Austria-Hungary. And one of the main reasons is bad things are happening to Russia. So when bad things are happening to your potential enemy, maybe you take it slightly easier, you save a little on budgets and this type of thing. Russia, of course, loses the, well, I guess I'm taking a bit of a stance here, but let's say they don't come out very well from the Russo-Japanese War in 1904-05, right? They have to make concessions in the peace. They have a mini revolution, partial failed revolution at home, so they're destabilized. So some of the Austro-Hungarian government officials and intel officers are thinking to themselves, well, maybe we don't have to be on absolute high alert about the Russian Empire at the moment, because they're kind of down and out, right? So there are some relaxations. There's an exchange program that begins, for example, between Austria-Hungary and Russia, where some intel officers from the other side will spend some time in the other country trying to learn the language. Radl goes on one of these exchanges in a Russian Empire-controlled city, let me word that cautiously, known as Kazan. In Western Asian Russia, let's say, very Eastern European Russia. So you do have a bit of a relaxation. There's a reorganization as well at the same time, especially then in the second half of that decade, they're starting, the Austro-Hungarians are, to try to organize the Evidence Bureau more professionally. They divide themselves into country-focused groups. They add a cipher group, for example. And you have Radl in this. I don't want to steal your thunder, but Radl becomes this, a prominent figure in this expanding organization after they readjust to the potential Russian threat after 1908, because there's a crisis and relations deteriorate again.
And before we look at Radl in particular, I think we really, really do need to emphasize that when we say this is the first sort of professional counterintelligence setup, the first professional intelligence setup, that's true. Britain isn't doing anything like this at the time. You have these kind of informal intelligence setups. You had these, as you say, when threats are high, bodies are brought together to do these things. But it's not going to be really be until World War One where we start to see like the Admiralty start to have a dedicated intelligence setup. And it's not until World War II really that you get that real setup that comes together in the form of military intelligence in Britain, of which MI5 and MI6 are the two that remain today. And maybe Jesse, at some point I'll drag you back on and we'll do all the MIs.
Okay.
Because everyone forgets that kind of like it's called 5 and 6 for a reason. That means there were at least four more. And actually they went up to about number 11, I think.
Jeez.
But it kind of gets you that impression of that this is the formalization of intelligence. It's starting to happen at this period. And Austria-Hungary are really at the forefront of this. But that's both a blessing and a curse, because it means it's great. You get the chance to innovate. You get smart people, and Radl's smart, that come in and do that. It also means you're not really aware yet of the ways in which you can be fully compromised when you have a permanent setup. And there's your ominous foreshadowing, listeners, for what happens later. But let's talk a bit about Radl first. So I'll do the very basic bit, which obviously he's born in 1864. So he's almost born as some of these wars are going on. He is almost a child of this period that those wars, the Sardinian and Prussian wars, create. He is born actually in what is now Ukraine. And he came from a relatively poor family. He's actually the son of a railway clerk. And so he doesn't have those extensive family connections. He rises very well and is very successful in his early career in the Austro-Hungarian army. And I think that tells us something about how smart he actually is and how good he is at what he does, because he doesn't have strong aristocratic family connections or money to fall back on. And yet, despite that, he ends up going and studying at the war school in Vienna. And that's an incredibly prestigious thing, isn't it? I mean, only accepts 50 entrants a year at this point. So tell us maybe a bit more about, like, what does that represent in terms of telling us about him?
Well, I think the bureaucracy and the army are real. I mean, they're real pillars of any state, of course. But in the discussions about Austria-Hungary, they loom even larger, because If you have a multinational empire, as of course the Austro-Hungarian Empire is, I mean, let's say it's not the only one that's multinational, but it's more of a focus for Austria-Hungary, given its later collapse and division. But this is really how you become someone if you don't have a von in your name, right? If you don't have this aristocratic of in your name in German. So for someone like Radl, who has the capacity, there is a general education system. The public education has improved dramatically in Austria-Hungary in the last decades. They're still behind, say, France or Germany, but they took off and surpassed Russia, for example, in that department. So someone like Radl can become someone either by becoming a member of the civilian bureaucracy or by becoming a member of the army. And you can do that regardless of your ethnicity. There are officers who are Bosnian Serbs, for example, even though Bosnia was just occupied in 1878 and only annexed to Austria-Hungary in 1908, 1909. So I'm not saying it's a perfect egalitarian world. Of course it isn't. But by the standards of the time, this is how you do stuff. And Radl is interesting as well because he's from a bit of a kind of a backwater of the empire. What's today Western Ukraine, Eastern Galicia is the name of the region. It's significant. It's got oil, for example, at the time. It's got Austria-Hungary's main oil reserves, but it's one of the poorer parts of the empire, one of the less well-educated parts of the empire. Now, Radl wasn't an ethnic Ukrainian, which generally were one of the poorer groups, most lived in the countryside, but still comes from that area and ends up making it. I have read that he spoke German, Polish, Ukrainian, and Russian. And that's a product, that's something he would not be able to do if he hadn't come from the background that he came from, which I thought was interesting.
And I like, again, there's a whole episode we could do on language requirements in the Austro-Hungarian army as well, because
we could.
It's like you need to speak at least two languages if you're an officer in the Austro-Hungarian army, and actually realistically you need to speak at least three to be functional. That hints at it adds both this dynamism to officers who work their way up who are smart, because they're kind of born in the fires of having to be dynamic to succeed. And Radl's like that because, you know, as you mentioned earlier, he is fascinated with Russia, and that's partly proximity, but it's also a genuine interest, and he specializes in it as he studies. And that's how he first comes to become involved in the intelligence side, because in 1900 he's basically appointed into the Russian section within the Evidence Bureau as it is, and that's where he starts out, isn't it?
And this is how he ends up. I don't know. Are we ready to dive into his to his saga here? Have we set the stage?
I mean, I think we have to, on the basis that he is on the verge of diving into his saga here, isn't it?
History is driving the train here. We're just all passengers, right? So you have this kind of rising star. I mean, he's not a national star, but within the intel community in Austria-Hungary, and so why not take advantage of this exchange program that I mentioned that is established between the Russian Empire and Austria-Hungary? So in 1900, Radl takes advantage of this, goes to the town of Kazan. There are Russian officers in different towns in Austria-Hungary doing the same thing. And the idea is he'll learn the language and so on. This is the origin story, one of the origin stories of his eventual downfall, right? Because supposedly there were activities going on there. In any case, he comes back. I'll save some of the sordid details for a few moments from now. He comes back, and this is when his career takes off. From 1901 to 1907, he is a big shot in the Evidence Bureau. He's the head of espionage and counter-espionage. So you can kind of do different things when you're spying. You can try to stop the other guys from spying on you, which is counter-espionage, counter-intel, or you can gather information on them. And he's responsible for both of those flows until 1907. Then he gets appointed the deputy chief of the Evidence Bureau. So he's the number two of the whole organization between 1908 and 1910. And as we'll see, that's a useful position for him to be in. Until finally, he gets transferred to Prague, so out of Vienna to Prague, for the last 3 years of his life, as it would turn out, and he becomes chief of staff of the 8th Corps, which is an army formation that's stationed around Prague. So that's kind of his meteoric career path on paper, but of course, under the surface, there's all sorts of funny stuff going on.
So let's start digging into that then. So I will set the scene and then let you loose.
Okay.
You've kind of talked about it already. It's 1901. He has just returned from Russia. He is effectively 36-ish at this point. So he's kind of heading into what he'd hope is the start of the peak of his career. And he returns basically not just now a member of Russian intelligence, not a member of Austrian intelligence. He is now effectively a member of Russian intelligence as well. Possibly as early as this point, isn't he?
Yes, there was some debate about that. When did he become a double agent? When did this all begin? As far as I can tell from the historical literature, he doesn't quite get going. He doesn't quite switch sides, let's say, until a little bit later, until about 1907. So when you're trying to think about why do people do stuff, right? Why would people be involved in intel? Why would they become an informant for a foreign intel service? Or why would they become a double agent? He's been called the first ever double agent, by the way. I don't know if that claim can be fully verified, but I've seen it thrown around. I doubt it. Let's just say.
I see that as one of those ones where you can kind of go, yeah, on a technicality, maybe, because this is right. The first time we're dealing with professional services.
I was just going to say, yeah.
Yeah, the act of double agency has existed as long as agency has existed.
I mean, I guess intel, informally, some people call it the second oldest profession in the world. So, yeah.
And often very heavily linked to the oldest profession in the world.
Absolutely. In this case, well, maybe there's a very, very indirect connection. In any case, so when we talk about why would people do this kind of thing, sometimes we use an acronym called MICE, right? Those are the motivations. So we use this acronym called MICE to try to explain people's actions. You have money. So some people do it for money. You have ideology. If you're a committed communist, maybe you spy for the Soviet Union. You have compromise, which means you are compromised. So someone has information on you and blackmails you essentially into giving them your secrets, or ego. You want to feel good. You want to puff up your own importance. You want revenge on somebody. You're jaded, whatever. As it turns out, there were a couple different explanations as to why Radel started doing this. Do we want to start with the salacious version and then go to the more historically established version?
I think that's worth doing because the context around this, listeners and viewers, is that as Jesse says, MICE is important in context here. And it's also not to think of these things as absolute pillars. People don't just do it for one. They do it for sliding scales on all of those pillars. You might be doing it for a little bit. The money is nice, but you might also be doing it because they approached you because they had compromising material on you to begin with. And I think sometimes there's a tendency to simplify why people betray their country in this way. And so I think we kind of start with the common salacious one, and then maybe we pick that apart and show that actually this is a bit more complex. That seems to me the right approach here. So yeah, do you want to lay the ground? What's the in British terms the Sun newspaper, in American terms what, the New York Post version?
That's not that far from how it shook out. I would say the Canadian version is the Journal de Montréal. But anyway, so I just want to mention what he does first, so we can get that out of the way, right? So between 1907 and 1913, he is providing very high-level intel about Austro-Hungarian war preparations, fortifications, planning, all that sort of thing, to the Russian Empire and to Italy. as well, in to a slightly lesser extent. So he basically does this for about 6 years, and that's his act, his main act as a double agent. This all gets discovered in May 1913. At first, it's not public information. So what happens, the Austrian authorities get tipped off by the German intelligence. They've intercepted a letter. It's got a lot of money in it. It's for Poste Restante, for the post here in Vienna. So they stake out the post office to see who's going to come pick it up. Turns out it's Radl. Everybody freaks out. The head of the Austro-Hungarian army, Konrad von Hötzendorf, freaks out. And Radl ends up dead in his hotel. This, though, doesn't mean that the general public and the Austrian newspapers automatically know that he's been a double agent and all of this kind of stuff. It's supposed to be hushed up. It hits the papers, though, 2 weeks later. There's a sort of a muckraking journalist by the name of Egon Erwin Kisch. If there are any Austrophiles among your listeners, Gareth, they might have heard that name before. He becomes an author. He's kind of politically associated with the left. He also fights in the First World War. He also lies in his memoirs about being present for atrocities against Serbian civilians, etc., etc. So Kisch publishes an account of this scandal, saying Radl, our big counter-intel officer, former counter-intel head, has betrayed us to the Russians. And this hits the press. And essentially, there's a lot of valid information in what Kisch writes. So the basics, that there was a betrayal to the Russians, and some other details, like Radl was gay, and that becomes a part of the scandal. Did he do it because of that? Is that sort of related to his moral failings with treason? And that becomes part of the focus, right? So there's the sort of salacious side, or the more extra dramatic side of the story, is when he went on exchange to the Russian Empire, to Kazan, supposedly he was frequenting places where gay citizens of residents of Kazan would go to link up with each other. And as the story goes, a Russian intel officer by the name of Batyukin, Nikolai, found this out. And he just kept that to himself for a while until Radl became more important, and then used it to blackmail Radl. And the newspaper story supposedly interviews a locksmith who was there helping the police get into Radl's hotel room, saying, oh, the room was filled with, you know, immoral gay paraphernalia and perverse stuff and secret documents and Russian documents everywhere, you know, sort of.
And this is the thing, isn't it? It's from a tabloid perspective, even more so at this time.
Yes.
It allows an element of what we would call, in kind of modern study terms, gay panic.
Yes.
This idea that what you can do is create this thing of going, they are an other. And it was because they were an other that they could, that they were never really one of us, and this is why they've done this. And that really comes through, I think, in the tabloid version of this at the time, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And gay panic is connected to spy panic and spy fever, because this is not a new idea that people could be blackmailed, that type of thing. Radl is one of the big cases that connects spy fever, let's say, or paranoia with suspicion of gay people. We know it from the Cold War, for example, in the United States, and also in Canada, in a smaller example.
And Britain.
And Britain
as well.
You know, I'm not as familiar, you know. But so this is one of the reasons, because the perception is, first of all, being gay is immoral, and being a traitor is immoral in the eyes of many people at the time. So you have that association of that moral sort of casting of aspersions, but also that they can be blackmailed in this way. Now, we can sort of break all of these elements down a little bit with the help of the historians who've really done the research work in the past 20 plus, 25-ish years on the topic, to sort of see, well, what is there to this story? of blackmail, of this clandestine gay lifestyle connected to the treason, and so on. So if we try to look at the source, one of the sources, let's say, it's this idea that there's this Russian intel officer, Batyukhin, right, who's the one who discovers all of this. However, if we try to follow Batyukhin's trail a little bit, it's not that convincing, in the sense that Batyukhin survives the revolution, unlike many Russian officers who do not. He survives. He goes to Yugoslavia afterwards, and he teaches there for a while, and he writes a memoir. Now, Gareth, you know about historical memoirs.
I think it's rapidly becoming a sort of semi-topic on this, is just like how dubious historical memoirs are, and how much confidence some people place in them that they really shouldn't.
Right. See German general memoirs after World War II, right?
So, Hey, von Manstein, where are you on my shelf
behind
me?
Among others. So the deal is, we have to be careful about what memoirs say, because normally they're self-serving, right? If it's not an outright fabrication, okay. But, you know, there's a slant.
Yeah, they've got a slant. And I think the other thing is that, which we should mention, is that slant is not always necessarily deliberate or it's conscious. Because sometimes that slant can come about simply from the fact that you're writing about a thing 20 years after an event. And memory is malleable and memory changes. So when we say, listeners, that kind of don't trust memoirs, we're not saying because everyone is lying consciously. What we're saying is, just as that they are what we would call, inverted commas, primary sources, but they are, that doesn't mean that they are the exact truth. They are skewed in both conscious and subconscious ways. And that's very much the case here, isn't it?
Right, which many sources are. Now, what's really interesting about Batyukhin is, you would expect, if he's the guy who kind of was the architect of the greatest intel coup in history up to that point, and arguably still up until now, maybe, although we won't open that can of worms fully, you'd think his memoir would be chock full of that. He'd be patting himself on the back. He'd be giving interviews to Yugoslav newspapers about how awesome he was back then. But there isn't that. In his memoirs, he barely mentions it. In the records that they have of his teaching in Yugoslavia, it's not a big topic about Radl. So that's an odd omission. You would expect, as a part of your sort of reasoning approach to historical sources, to find something there from Batyukhin. But there's not much there. So that might cast some doubt on the idea that he manipulated the whole situation. On the other hand, we can look at the context about the reason for the blackmail. So would being a gay officer in the Austro-Hungarian army have been a cause for someone to go so far as to allow themselves to be blackmailed, right? What was the approach? Of course, officially, Austria-Hungary's arch-Catholic, the emperor and the pope are buddies. They've built 1,000 billion churches. They, you know, it's the official state religion, all of that. So it is a Catholic society, especially in the more conservative elements, the army, the aristocracy. But, especially in cities like Vienna, it's also a modern culture. There's also a tradition of, let's say, social liberalism to some extent. There are quite a lot of bachelors in the army. Part of that was policies where you had to pay to be able to get married. And part of that is because there were some gay people. And in high society and in more structured middle class and up society, there was some tolerance for being gay, not officially, publicly, but in practice. There was a general, Potiorek, for example, who was essentially known to be that way. There was a member of the royal family as well. And so I've seen an interesting argument that, you know, it's not a total social death sentence if people know that you're gay. It's just not, you know, publicly announced and accepted publicly. So that's another way we can kind of approach some of the elements of the tabloid version of the story and maybe call them into question a little bit.
And my suspicion has always been that one of the reasons that this isn't as well known now, and it should be well known now, is because there's a tendency to only view it through that tabloid lens that was the story at the time. That it's only really recent scholarship that's looked at this man and gone, actually, he was a hell of a lot more complex than people thought about. And maybe we can frame that again through the mice pillars that you set out. And that, I think, is one of the reasons this fascinates me, because so much of our study of this focused really on that compromise element. And I think in doing so, and what the modern studies have shown, is that maybe there's a bit more complexity to this than that, but that some of those other letters in our mice acronym might also be important. Just before we started recording, we were talking about cars. I think that's a conversation Redl would have quite liked to be involved in as well, isn't it?
Yes. Redl was a car guy, let's say. He was an aficionado of cars. He was an aficionado for the finer things in life in general, and those things usually cost you something. And this is one of the trails that historians have tried to explore in a little more detail as a way of trying to find maybe an explanation that fits the historical circumstances a little bit better. One detail, though, I've got to throw in before I finish that thought that I remembered I wanted to mention is with the idea of the entrapment, with the idea of the blackmail for being gay. We can poke another big hole in that story, and that is, you got to love when historians do their research. Things come out of the woodwork that sometimes, I hate to use the term, you know, game changer and stuff, but that are really interesting. There's a cable, a telegram from 1907 from the military, Russian military attaché in Vienna. And he's saying, okay, you know, I'm new in my job. His name's Marchenko. I'm new in my job. I'm reporting back home about some of the major figures in the scene in Vienna, in the intel scene. Because, of course, the military attaché, essentially they're an intel agent operating in wherever they're posted. And so he sends this cable where he talks about Radel, not because he's necessarily knows that Radel is the double agent. He doesn't, because Radel is giving that information through an indirect channel. But he has a small assessment of Radel. Okay, he's important. He's the deputy head of our potential enemy's intel service. And there's a line in there that says, okay, he's this, he's that, he's smart, he speaks languages, he's kind of vain, and he's a lover of women. He's a ladies' man. Which, if the military attaché of the Russian Empire is so far off base to think that this guy's a ladies' man, when in fact he's a gay man, it might mean that Russian intel was not responsible for turning him and blackmailing him. Now, it may just mean that the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing, but I thought that was a classic moment where you have, wait a minute, maybe the hot version of the story is not quite what we think.
Yeah, 100%. And I think it really talks to how complex motivations on these things are. And also on the receiving end of a double agency. So yeah, like you say, different people might know someone is an agent when other people might not, because it's actually quite useful in some instances to compartmentalize that information, both to protect it, but also to ensure that you always have to operate on the assumption that your opponent, for want of another word, is at least reading some of your mail. So you want to make sure that you're not leaving clues in that can reveal things. And yeah, I must admit, it's one of the reasons why I find this case fascinating, is because it's one of those ones that you only have to poke slightly to discover this huge level of complexity lurking between the surface. Perhaps before we explore what some have been his other motivations, I think it's worth us just pausing to reiterate again that what being a double agent meant in terms of what he was doing. So just to remind people, what he's really doing here is passing on things like those mobilization plans, like fortification plans, documentation that is very useful to the Russians, to the Italians, when they're planning the possibility of a war. Because obviously throughout this period, that information is changing as mobilization plans evolve, as fortifications are expanded and such like. We should also mention, though, that some of the effort he goes to and some of the things he does to ensure that he is not discovered, which, and this is the darker side of this story, it's worth not thinking of Radel as this slightly wronged individual who, oh well, apart from some paperwork, no one else suffered, because there is a human cost to this as well, isn't there?
Yes, primarily to anyone within the Russian Empire who'd been working with Austro-Hungarian intelligence, right? So Radel does a few different things to make his system work, right? So he's providing these documents indirectly through a Russian official in Switzerland, primarily. And one of the things that he's responsible for, Radel, is running the network of agents that the Austro-Hungarians have in the Russian Empire to get information about what the Russians are doing or might do or intend to do. However, if we look at the capabilities, the relationships of Austro-Hungarian intelligence in the Russian Empire while Radel is acting as a double agent, essentially their network collapses, right? So he sees to it. Now, this is a little bit circumstantial because we can't always, you know, connect the dots one to one. This agent, Radel, told them, and he was taken out. But basically, there's a massive collapse in the Austro-Hungarian network of informants and sources in this period of time in the Russian Empire. And basically, by the time Radel gets caught in May 1913, and then possibly commits suicide in the hotel and or commits suicide by cop, I guess you could say, depending on the account. By that time, Austria-Hungary's network is not down to zero, but it's been massively compromised. They have very little ability to gather information inside the Russian Empire, and they have very little ability to defend against Russian intel operations inside the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And some historians have said, you know, this Radel plays a big role in this. And that means that some people have died, right? That some people have ended up in a Siberian, well, gulag, I guess is the later term, but a Tsarist prison camp in the East, or been executed or what have you. So that is one cost to Radel's benefit. And another one is what happens to Russian agents inside Austria-Hungary, because Radel can show that he's successful. He can further strengthen his position. I mean, no one's really going to doubt him being that high up. As you mentioned earlier, the science of intel is not developed enough to really have, you know, counter checks and that sort of thing to understand what could go fully wrong. So it is suspected that he worked to some degree with Russian intel to discover a few Russian agents in Austria-Hungary. From the Russian point of view, this keeps their operation going. It's perfect. It costs them a few local collaborators, let's say. The Yandrich affair was a famous one, where a Bosnian Serb officer was spying for the Russians, and then Radel outed him and discovered him. I'm not saying there's an exact link between Yandrich and a purposeful Russian, you know, betrayal of him, but this is what's in the mix at the moment.
That's it. There is a human cost to this, and that is part of the intelligence game. That is always part of the intelligence game, as it's called. But I do think we need to remember that this is a human cost, that in many ways, to keep his career as a double agent going, there's a human cost to that, as well as his own morality and everything else. But I mean, financially, he does very well out of this. I mean, I've seen kind of modern estimates that say he was paid, you know, in modern terms, you're looking at almost £3 million that he's paid over the course of this by the Russians alone for what he provides and what he does. And that does allow him to fuel an incredibly flamboyant lifestyle that I always sit there and think should have triggered a lot more alarm bells than it actually did.
It should have. And this is why much of the literature focuses on this when it comes to what's his motivation. There's a lot of focus on the M in mice, right? On the money aspect. The way he gets caught is through these anonymous letters that are essentially wads of cash in envelopes, right? So the one that gets intercepted by the Germans and that leads to his downfall has 6,000 crowns in it, which is a lot of money, right? These are huge sums, as you say. He owns two of the fanciest automobiles in the Austro-Hungarian Empire. He lives in a giant hotel suite. He's known for his luxurious kind of tastes in his social circles. When he incurred debt, he'd pay them in cash. I mean, right away, look, I'm a farm boy from Quebec, and I know if you're paying a debt with a giant stack of cash, something is off. Like, you don't have to be that worldly to see a problem there. But as is very often the case in intel history and in history generally, sometimes the explanation for why something works out the way it does is because people make mistakes and people are not that bright. And so the Austro-Hungarian authorities were supposed to do regular checks on officers and high-ranking officers. And in his file, in Radel's file, there was a whatever, normal financial check from 1908. Says he's fine. That was supposed to happen once a year, but it never happened again after 1908. Because, well, what are you going to do? It's the Austrian. Sometimes, in unflattering terms in German, you'd call it Schlamperei, which basically means sloppiness. So not always doing things the Prussian way, let's say, being a little more easygoing. So this is kind of the going primary explanation for his motivation. It was for this money. And even so, even though he was getting all this cash, sometimes it was 6,000 crowns, sometimes it was like 17,000 crowns in a single payment, he accumulated massive debts up to, at some points, 100,000 crowns, which is unthinkable. Like, that's, you're never ever going to pay that off on your colonel's salary, even as chief of staff for the 8th Corps in Prague. You could live for another 100 years and never pay off 100,000 crowns. So that is a part of the story. And that also affects, there's another little, I guess, corroborative piece of evidence, because he also spied for the Italians, not as much as for the Russians. And we have an account from an Italian intel officer who basically said, someone anonymously approached us in Vienna by letter, basically saying, hey, I'm me. I have access to all sorts of high-ranking documents. Just give me money and I'll give them to you. And then he started doing that. So, and it turns out that was Radel. So I think that speaks to the significance of that motivation. It doesn't mean it's the only one. It doesn't mean there's no shades of gray and complications. But if you are out and out of your own volition writing to a foreign power and offering them in exchange for money, you know, that's something different than having been blackmailed by a Russian intel officer because you're gay.
And we talked about this at the top of the show, but I do think this is a good example of where the Evidence Bureau's kind of, being an early forerunner of professional intelligence is both a blessing and a curse.
Yeah.
The blessing is that they actually do get a really solid setup. And we do need to acknowledge that Radel set up some really innovative ways in how he managed his agents and how he managed intelligence gathering and detection. But the downside is you don't know yet what you need to put in place to watch for your flags, watch for your warning flags. Things that now modern intelligence agencies would go, okay, large debts, payments from things, visits to certain places, all of these things would trigger flagging of some variety. that would then combine to make it so an inspection that maybe wouldn't necessarily happen regularly now does happen again. You know, those things are now standard in a way that they weren't then. And I think one of the lessons for various agencies in the future from this case is, how do you make sure that you do not find yourself in a situation where you get a radle? Now, how successful they are at that varies, as various British spy scandals will show. But at least there's a warning there that other agencies in future, in theory, learn from. We should talk and just really kind of summarize how he falls. How does this house of debts rather than cards he's built come tumbling down in the end?
Well, it happens in May 1913, but there's a very close call for him in 1909 already. And I think this actually speaks to the point you just made, because one of the things that doesn't exist really at this time is Intel alliances. Like today, we might think about Five Eyes, which is an Intel sharing alliance between five of the English-speaking countries in the world. Well, at the time, you don't really have these kind of collaborative structures so much. And if you had, they might have caught him a bit earlier. For example, in 1909, in St. Petersburg, capital of Russian Empire at the time, a British military attaché is talking to an Italian military attaché. And he says, hey, I happen to know that the Austro-Hungarians have been compromised, that somebody there is giving the Russians whatever they're asking for. And so on paper, Italy and Austria are allies. In practice, not so much, as we would see in 1914. But this Italian officer, I think his name was Spanocchi, if I remember right. In any case, he then ends up in Vienna and says, he goes to the head of the Evidence Bureau, who's a man by the name of Horlichka, and he says, hey, I've heard that you guys have a problem. You might want to look into that. And Horlichka says, okay, thank you for the information. You know, that's very, very serious if that's the case. I know just the guy you should talk to, Colonel Radle. So go and talk to Colonel Radle, and he will be the one to root this out, because he's the guy, right? So if all roads lead to Rome and you don't have the right kind of institutional setup, as you mentioned, to safeguard yourself, you know, these are the things that can happen. And obviously that investigation went nowhere. What eventually...
Yeah, it's almost a sort of meme equivalent of the guy in the hot dog suit and outside the ruined hot dog car and in the shop going, we all want to find who did this. I mean, that's Radle at that point in that investigation.
Precisely. So his downfall in the end, he's getting these envelopes of cash sent to Vienna. They are posted from inside Germany, from a town just inside the border with the Russian Empire. And they're sent anonymously, and they're addressed to a fake name. I think it's Nikon Nizetas or something along those lines. And he's supposed to go and then pick them up in Vienna. One of them, for whatever reason, gets returned to the post office from which it was sent. And the German intel had been collaborating and working with and having exchanges with Austro-Hungarian intel much more intensively in the 10 years leading up to the First World War. So they intercepted. Somehow they connected potentially to a French agent. They informed the Austrians. So they set up a sting basically in Vienna where they're waiting for him to show up. I might have spoiled this at the top of the show, but they're waiting at the post office. He shows up. They follow him back to the hotel. They identify him. Everyone freaks out. Everyone freaks out because politically, this is like the worst case scenario. The worst case scenario. And, you know, shame is not to be underestimated as a motivating emotion in history. Maybe slightly less today, we think sometimes, but man, at the time, it's a big deal. So the head of the army or the head of the military, Konrad von Hötzendorf, he's like, we gotta take care of this now. I think the exact quote is, it must happen tonight. And so there's no arrest, there's no trial, there's no, you know, forensic collection of evidence before doing something. They confront him at the hotel, they give him a pistol, and they say, you know what you have to do. He does get shot with that pistol. The question is, did he do it himself or not? There's some conflicting accounts. Some of the hotel staff apparently afterwards said, no, after a couple hours, he just burst out of the room and then they shot him. So it's hard to reconstruct the exact final moments. But because this was going to be such a political bombshell, if it ever became public, which they didn't intend at the time, right? It wasn't public right away. It only came several weeks or a couple of weeks later. Yeah, the powers that be basically said, no, we're going to get him to commit suicide immediately and no investigations, no nothing. And it was sort of swept under the rug internally as well. They didn't really fully try to establish, you know, what exactly has been compromised here. So that's, in the end, that's how it went down. Tragically, his lover broke up with him earlier that day, which also adds, you know, another little element from that other side of the story there. But most historians have concluded that that was not the reason he killed himself. It was the direct order to do so.
And just to finish, I think, again, we've given plenty of reasons throughout this why this should be better known. It does have an impact on how later intelligence agencies learn to act in the aftermath of discovery of a thing like this and learn how to look better for instances of this happening. And actually, one of the things you touched on at the end there is that there isn't really a proper investigation into what he'd leaked. And by letting him commit suicide, or, you know, if the other account is true, by gunning him down, what they lost was the ability to effectively interrogate him and go, okay, let's try and work out the scale of what has been compromised. And that left the Austro-Hungarians in a sudden position of going, well, we now have to either assume that everything has been compromised or act as if nothing has been compromised. We don't really have a middle ground we can work to. The other thing, though, I personally think this should be better known for is because, and again, we have sort of touched on this already, is it is a foundational pillar in this growth of the gay panic idea and its link to intelligence. Now, McCarthy, during the Red Scare in the US, will directly cite this case, this instance, as a reason why homosexual people can't be trusted. Like, this is a foundational pillar of that, and it's a thing that people keep coming back to. And that, to me, is a reason why we should really, really, really study this more. And I'm glad recently we've had so much more study of this. But, I mean, is there any other reasons you think it should be better known as well?
I think there's a few. I mean, I would agree with the ones you mentioned. The impact of this idea that gays can't be trusted in an intel context is very persistent. It makes me think of the old dilemma of, are there lessons from history? And I think, I mean, the answer is yes, but maybe not the low-hanging fruit ones that we often think about. Here you might say, is the lesson that you need to structure your intel organization differently, that you need safeguards, that you need to be cautious about intel, that, you know, you can't concentrate too much authority into a single pair of hands? Is that the lesson? Or is the lesson that gays can't be trusted? You know, so that I think those two ways of thinking about lessons of history, it's a good example for some of them, because the idea of lessons about history gets bandied about, I think, a little too cavalierly. The other one is a more difficult one, which is, you know, how much impact does intel have in a larger scale? So yes, we know some of the types of documents that he provided. We know, for example, in the last year, he provided about 24 documents. So we have a bit of an example of the scale. But did that impact the opening campaign of the First World War between Austria-Hungary and Russia. That is much, much, much harder to say. Obviously, there's a lot that went into that, but essentially the conclusion is it couldn't really be decisive because of the scale, because of other factors, because of other information that's available, open source, as we would call it, information. So I think, you know, we have to look at this as being a significant event, but we have to resist the temptation of, you know, the tabloid press to say this decided the 1914 campaign or what have you, you know. There's always a few more little aspects to it. But yes, I think it's a very interesting case. It's an important case for those reasons. And I'm glad that you had me on to talk about it today.
That's been brilliant. And thanks so much for coming on. Before we geek out a bit more for our rabbit hole members, thanks to everyone for listening. Jesse, where can people find you if they want to hear more of your kind of, or read or hear more of you?
Well, you can find me at various pubs in Vienna if you're able to make the trip.
Which I highly recommend doing.
Indeed, Gareth has done. I'm on Blue Sky if you want to find me there. You can also find some of my work on YouTube, produced by Real Time History, or as well on any podcast platform. Of course, there's the World War II podcast that I host with Matthias Strohn for Battle Guide, which is World War II, Both Sides of the Wire.
I'm absolutely dragging Matthias along because I think this podcast is finally his opportunity to talk about Frederick the Great.
Absolutely.
And stop bugging you with it in sessions. Thank you for listening, everyone. And don't forget, it is absolutely so useful to me and to us if you rate us on your podcast platform of choice. That genuinely makes a difference. It's not just about acknowledging, making us feel fuzzy and good and me feel fuzzy and good. What it genuinely does is it means that it's more likely that other people will discover the podcast, and then they will learn and listen to the things you love too. I'd also like to remind you that you can go to untitled-history.com, and that's where you can join the rabbit hole. And if you join the rabbit hole, you will get exclusive extended episodes, including the bits that Jesse and I are about to talk about now, but also additional bits like me pulling books off my bookcase behind you and telling you the story behind them. Visits and little trips I do to museums and details on that, and generally just have a good discussion with other history fans and history people, as well as interact with me and some of our guests. You've been listening to the Untitled History Podcast, a Battle Guide production. If you've enjoyed this episode and would like to support the podcast, why not head over to our dedicated supporter page? There, for the cost of a cup of tea, you can decide which subjects we cover next, get access to exclusive behind-the-scenes content, and join a community of like-minded people. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
His hotel was right across the street from a very famous cafe in Vienna. So oh, right. Radl's Hotel, where it all goes down and shoots himself and or gets shot, whatever. It's right across the street from, which is now a bit of a tourist trap, called Café Central.
Yeah. I have been there.
Exactly. And some, you know, maybe some of your listeners out there might have heard of it before. It's a bit kind of famous. Vienna at this time is a place where a lot of famous people end up passing through, including people like Lenin, Stalin, Trotsky, also Hitler. And Lenin, Stalin, and Trotsky, when they were in Vienna, used to frequent that cafe. Now, this doesn't mean anything in the grand scheme of explaining history and all of that. I just can't help but thinking the spy scandal of the century, the, to use a German phrase, the Ur scandal, the original alpha scandal of intel history is happening at a hotel. And right across the street, you have the cafe where, like, Stalin is chilling or whatever. I don't know. I just think that's kind of...
You have been listening to the extra bit on the Untitled History Podcast. If what you have heard there is a thing you want to hear more of, then I'm sorry it faded out. But what you will have to do is back us, and then you can find out more. So don't forget to back us at theuntitled-history.com for more of what you've heard here, and more extra episodes in future. Oh, final note. If a cat jumps on me at any point, just ignore it. That's kind
oh, we
got
to run with that, our, man. This is podcasting gold or social media gold.
Effectively, yes. Like we're taking the attitude that we just pretend the cat doesn't exist, and everyone's like, "Wait, there's a cat on this."
Drives engagement.
So I think that's exactly. That's absolutely what we're going to do.